This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci.
And Jacob!
Educated educators talking education.
Man. Love that. Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Educated educators talking, you know, education. Although it's producer's choice day, Jacob's choice. Yeah, and you heard him in there, you know, Dr. Johnny, Dr. Tim, and Jacob.
Sounding like Mr. Bill. Wasn't that? You remember that skit?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Man.
Mr. Bill.
Oh, yeah.
That's me.
Jacob. Yeah, Jacob's our Mr. Bill. Guys, I'm bleeding out over here. I'm just,
well, it seems like somebody might have Mr. Bill you then. Look at that. Okay. For anybody watching on YouTube right now, if you had an aversion to blood, we apologize profusely for Johnny Lupinacci showing you his bleed out right there.
The only thing he's gonna profuse as our apologies is the amount of blood coming out of Johnny's leg.
There he is. Well, hey, you can obviously tell it is Friday and producer's choice, Jacob's choice.
That's
because
right
away we're already in that mood because, yeah, this is the day of the week. This is the podcast of the week where
it's the fun of all fun.
Yeah, things get a little bit crazy because Tim and Johnny just have to kind of sit there and think a little bit because it's all in Jacob's hands. Jacob, what's going on with you? What do you got for us today, my friend?
Well, Tim, Johnny, you're absolutely right about one thing. It is time for the Producer's Choice Show.
Anything goes. It's going to be Producer's Choice.
Ow!
You now have two choices.
Chairman of the board, Jacob.
Ow!
Jacob, chairman of the board.
I bet the board is spelled B-O-R-E-D.
We choose to go to the moon.
Life's full of tough choices, isn't it?
You chose poorly.
Tim, Johnny, uh-oh. I appreciate you being here so much. It's an honor to have you here on your own show, honestly. I mean, to get to interview two geniuses like you guys means a lot to me, and especially because you were talking about this is a fun show, and I thought I'd throw a wrench in that and ask you hard questions today.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Whoa. I lulled you into a false sense of security with that wacky AI show last week, only to get my gotcha questions out for the next one.
Is Johnny going to be able to handle it with the bleeding episode that's occurring right now?
He's going to be just fine.
I'm going to be all right, Tim. Just okay. A lot of blood.
Just a lot of blood. But other than that, he's absolutely fine. And if anything, he'll give some interesting answers with this new lightheaded delirium he's in. I think that'll be fun for the folks at home. Mm. So to introduce this one, guys, we're finally leaving budget season behind, both here in Wisconsin and across the country. Governor Tony Evers has signed Wisconsin's new budget, and President Trump's big, beautiful boondoggle is soon to take effect. This comes after weeks and weeks of arguments from both sides of the political divide over every aspect of our respective budgets, from forestry to sanitation, policing to rural Wi-Fi, and everything in between. We've just discussed every possible thing that a government can possibly fund. But there's one thing about funding and budgeting that a novice like myself, an uneducated educator, one might say, still doesn't quite understand. And that's why today I've asked two experts in education to join me here on their own show. Wow. Dr. Tim Slecker, Dr. Johnny Lupinacci. Thank you both for being here today.
Wow. Oh, you betcha. It's Friday. Wouldn't miss it for the world.
Yeah. Always kind of ready to go, you know.
No, I'm a little, Tim, you're right.
You make me nervous, Jacob. I mean, you know.
I'm here to guide you safely into wonderful discussions, Tim. I'm not here to get you, despite that thing I said about the question. But, So anyway, now that I have two experts like you here, I have a question that I'd like to ask that I think that two education experts like yourselves can help me with. Fellas, I'd like to start off by asking you if both of you together could explain to me and the audience, how is education funded in America?
All right. Johnny, I'm gonna jump in quickly because I know you've got a whole lot to say on this. I mean,
we could do it together. Yeah, I'll fill in the gaps.
Take
it in.
How is it funded? Because as Johnny points out on the show, ain't nothing free. Okay, when we say a free public education to all citizens in this country, sometimes people go, it ain't free. You know, it costs something. And in fact, you always typically hear we got to quit throwing money at public education because it doesn't get a lot of results. And that assumes something that, Jacob, people have money to be throwing. So let's first kind of break it down. The idea of a public education system rooted in democracy is that first we believe that education is responsible. The responsibility of education falls on us, the citizens of the townships, the communities, the states. And I'm going to stop right there at states because this is a states' rights issue that Johnny's going to say. And from our earliest kind of visions of what public education in America is it, and how are we going to fund this? Well, the simplest way is that through your taxes, right? Specifically, what has happened for American public education in the states is that comes mostly from real estate taxes or people who have property within a boundary of a school district, there's a proportion of what they pay every year or quarterly, however it is, and that goes to the school system in that area, and then that money gets divvied out across students. That's the primary funding mechanism for public schools. So everybody within that area, well, and I'll be careful, Johnny will help me with the everybody, maybe not, but we're all supposed to be coming together to put in a little of something that we have because we want to generate a public education system that delivers the best quality system of compliance. That was the other show. Bringing together a public education system. And so it's through taxes, Johnny.
Yeah, I think that's a great way. And I'm just going to break it into the simple. I've simplified even more, Tim.
You're gonna simplify.
Well, yeah, because it's a good question that Jacob brings up, yeah. Especially coming off of these debates about budgets and I'll own this. I'm regularly saying we're underfunding education, right? So who am I saying that to? Well, I'm saying that to state legislators, right? I'm also saying that to our federal politicians. Who could do more right now? It's a little tough. I see, like, we're handcuffed with the big, beautiful bill, you know, and the dismantling of the Department of Ed. But when I teach this in school, right, I bring out the pie chart. So I'm going to do a little bit of like the pie chart, Jacob, right? Typically, and I'm going to sort of generalize a bit, Tim nailed it. You know, education is a state, right? So states set the budgets for what schools are getting in terms of how much money they're getting per pupil to do operations, to sort of run schools. But think about it like this. About somewhere in the low 40% of funding for schools comes locally in your state. Like Tim talked about, property taxes is sort of the primary impetus for this. School district collect taxes based on the assessed value of homes, right, and businesses within their boundaries. And this sometimes creates some inequality because let's say I'll just pull a random example. Maybe I have a company like Amazon in my business district, right? And so the tax kind of money that's going into that local school area could be astronomically disproportionate. So typically it's about 40% of the money is funded through local kinds of property taxes or business taxes. Somewhere in the other low 40% of this, and it varies state to state, is coming at the state level. Mm-hmm. So most of the funding, if you can imagine the pie graph, where, you know, at a minimum of 80% of that pie graph is either local, my surrounding community, the neighborhood, the home values, and the business taxes locally, and then the state funding. So at the state level, you know, that's another big chunk of what's 80% of the money going to schools. The remaining amount is federal funding. It's usually around 12%. You know, I know if I was, you know, in a state that funds only 40% locally, 40%, we are only at 80, right? I could say could get up to 20, but it's usually the low 40s. It's usually around 12% that's funded by federal funding. And that's sort of something that we're going to keep a close eye on right now, because as we've heard, right, those funds are being cut significantly. It's already a small amount, but the, even that small amount, it's the things like Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that's funded, or Title I, right, for schools with high percentages of low-income students. Those are federal programs that primarily have made up about, you know, 12% of the budget are making up that rest. The additionally, Tim, you mentioned this too. Everybody in Wisconsin knows this well, and most listeners around the country are familiar with this. When there's something specific a district wants to do that they don't have enough money in the tax base for, or the state's not funding, they have to do things like bonds, special levies, grants, fundraising activities. So increasingly, we're seeing more of that slice of the pie chart, needing to be accounted for by those historically additional sources. And everybody here knows that that's that vote that happens when we're saying, mm-hmm. vote yes on the levy, vote yes on the grants, right? Vote yes on the bonds to, you know, build a new building, or, you know, have a new facility for our track and field program, or those things. Things that are often, we say here on Busted Pencils, essentials that historically were covered through state funding or local funding. It's just not there, right? So if you think about the pie, 80% or more of it even is state or local tax dollars, right? And primarily, so the other thing, Jacob, I'll throw in there, because you're making it a nerdy Friday for us, and I'm living up to that expectation as I'm bleeding out here.
Right? And you're geeking out.
Yeah. The additional part of that is that states, not all, but a lot of states, and that's why I say when we say schools are underfunded and we're speaking to legislators or we're people like in Wisconsin, go to the Capitol, right, and speak in Madison on behalf of what are the needs of our, say, rural schools or our urban schools or just our public schools in general. They're advocating that legislators, you know, provide the essentials. And that's what we often say here on mm-hmm. Busted Pencils, that we've underfunded education, that it's expensive to have strong public schools. And we're continually putting more on, not calling anybody a moron, but yeah. we're putting additional, you know, responsibility on local citizens through those additional sources. So as we need to do more, as things cost more for our mm-hmm. schools and communities, that burden has been placed on the everyday family, right? Or the everyday small business in our local communities to, you know, pick up the slack. And what we say state to state over and over again, especially in Wisconsin, you know, the voters have said this over and over, is the state should be funding schools primarily. You should not be putting this additional responsibility to provide the essentials on the families, on the community. It should be on the state. We have enough money. Mm-hmm. It should be on business taxes. It should be on tighter regulations around, you know, doing business for big corporations. And as we know, Jacob, right, the beautiful big bill or whatever we want to call that monster, whatever we want to call that monster, you know, that's been passed, has done the opposite, right? Okay. It's created more tax breaks for those large institutions that could be funneling important money into investing into, you know, our economies and into our, you know, public schools.
Yep. It's a just quick addition. So what Johnny's really pointing out here, Jacob, is that when the local taxpayer can get rightfully inflamed and angry about the amount of their money going to pay for school taxes, what we also try to do on the show is point out and say, okay, but who's not? And why has it turned into that you, the individual taxpayer, property owner, has to pay more? And even this, though, too, John, you know, we talk about this. It's the whole idea too of property owning exclusively, and you know, some people have kind of loaded this into, you know, so you're just picking on individual homeowners, and yeah, it comes across as homeowners, but you know, as Johnny points out, where are those other resources? And I'll give one example in Wisconsin specifically. When I lived there, I lived down in the town of Verona. And if you know what's down in Verona, it's the Google of the Midwest. That would be epic. And that's where right now, if we want to know, you know, what Johnny's blood type is, we would just hack into Epic. We could pull up his My Chart or something like that, and we'd know everything we need to know about him. Huge billion-dollar corporation. It's not that they don't pay anything, but they don't pay a proportion of what they are worth and what they're bringing in as the way a property owner. So when I owned a house in Verona, the rate of taxation that was charged on me based on the value of my property was not even close to what Epic should have been paying had the same type of rules applied to them. Instead, they are in lieu of taxes, they write a check.
Right. And this is important, Tim. What you're pointing out is a really important sort of tension in the system. No system is perfect, but in efforts to equalize things a bit, because otherwise, like if we said, hey, Epic happens to be in the Verona, you know, district. I don't remember exactly what that district is, Tim, but we say, hey,
Verona.
Yeah. So there's a lot of money going into Verona schools. You know, the states have worked algorithms to help mm-hmm. equalize things. So some of that money goes to the state. The state distributes it out, mm-hmm. you know, based on like count days and different, you know, requirements that the state right. asks of its public schools to follow. So there is, it used to be just straight, you know, this is like kind of, one might even argue still existing sort of Jim Crow era kinds of things, or like, you know, some lines drawn
yeah.
Between classes and also between, you know, races and communities, is that, you know, depending on where you lived, the quality of your school hinged on, you know, how much of the local tax or business tax was directly in your district. And that right. was one way to kind of to continue inequality. And yeah. we're still seeing a lot of that, even though states like Wisconsin have done a lot to say, hold on. Yeah. The money has to go to the state level and the state disperses it out. Right. So there is an effort.
Jacob, you didn't realize asking this question what you were going to get, did you, here? Because
he knew there was a little red herring in there.
He knew. You know, even in Verona's, you know, kind of specifically, as Johnny points out, you know, the potential that could exist there is that if the value of, say, Epic's property was taxed proportionately to what residents and homeowners are paying, the amount of windfall for, say, the Verona school district versus a neighboring school district, say, like in McFarland, could really create a funding just disproportionate inequity that is just something that, again, we're talking about public schools, so that money going to a central place and then being redistributed. But even within that, and Johnny, I'm sure, will verify this, you know, there are those inequalities because of, you know, again, the value of home ownership in that. You can see that disproportionate of the taxes and how they get spent at school districts like Verona through all kinds of things. And guess what? Verona does get a little something extra by doing that. And, you know, these are just realities. And so, you know, I'm sure many listeners can point out that, you know, there are ways, I guess, sadly, to take advantage of the economic situation and really continue to fund our public schools inequitably and disproportionately based on, you know, the class of people and businesses that live in a certain geographical area.
Well, thank you very much, Tim and Johnny. That was supposed to be the 60-second question, but it's now been 20 minutes. Good answer. What I was looking for was property taxes. So thank you very much. But what I'm getting from your answers is that basically, Johnny, if I'm getting this right, and please correct me if I'm not, you're saying basically 40% comes from right here in my town, our very local funding through taxes. 40% comes from the state, and then 12-ish percent, like you said, federal. Immediately, it stands out, and I don't know much about this. That's why I'm asking you these questions, and I think I'm learning something. I hope people out there listening are learning something, too. But immediately, it stands out that this seems to set up a very unequal situation where it's coming from property taxes in your school district. That seems like a very obvious, glaring issue with setting it up that way.
Well, and that's right, Jacob. That's where states, especially like Wisconsin, have like a state-level algorithm, right? And some requirements there, right? So like it's not, it used to be direct, and now it's not exactly direct, right? So there's, you know, a combination of general revenue from income tax, sales tax, and other sources. And there's like a formula. I don't have it off the top of my head, state to state. But, you know, all the states have a formula designed to distribute money based on factors like school enrollment, school needs, you know, submitting your budget requests. And as Tim said, district wealth. So you are rewarded for your local wealth, which, Jacob, you hit the nail on the head. It automatically sets up some inequality, right? If you happen to have some local wealth, whether that's like a thriving business, like Tim refers to Epic, or, you know, I made the reference to Amazon here in Washington, right? Those local schools do see a benefit from those businesses being there.
Now, in the vein of what you're saying there, Johnny, would it be fair to say that a big part of what that other 40% from the state is doing, and maybe even what the federal funding is doing, is trying to fix the problem that your initial version of funding is creating to start things off?
Jake, in fact, I'm glad you went there, Jacob, because coming back to, you know, people say it's insignificant, that 12% from the federal. In fact, if you look at why there is a federal presence in states' rights public education, it largely came from recognizing those disparities and that the federal contribution was supposed to be some form of an antidote to kind of level out those funding inequities. And so when people talk about doing away with the Department of Education, which the Supreme Court ruled this week that Donald Trump can continue the dismantling, people say, you know, what's the big deal? Well, there's a big deal right there, because that is why there was a federal presence in one of the reasons why, but, you know, really looking at and saying, school district over here in this rural community that just lost a lot of economic leverage through closures of industry and mining and things like that, they're now eligible for more federal funding when you have a federal Department of Education.
So with that problem, and it seems like it's acknowledged, our states are acknowledging it, that there is a problem with the fundamental way we fund our schools. Nationally, it seems that we acknowledge there's a problem. We try to fill it in with federal funding. Why do we keep this system that is so flawed that every level seems to recognize that it doesn't work and needs greater funding from other sources? Why do we still do it this way?
I mean, the short answer,
am I missing, Jacob, something about how this is a good thing?
No, I think the short answer I would have is, I would ask the question, do we really care about children? Mm-hmm. You know, because they kind of get put to the side in this. It's like, they're low on the priority. Not saying they should be. I'm not advocating for that. I'm just saying, like, we often sort of sell them short in these instances, and in a case where we might really want a new business to come to our community. And, you know, our legislators or local governments might say something like, hey, you'll have some tax breaks if you bring your business here, or you won't have state tax necessarily as high as you would to bring your business here because we're enticed by the potential local employment. And I'm also saying that's not a bad thing. Like, we need jobs for people too, but there's often a lot of times where kids are sold short, right? And I ask that question, like, if we really cared about children, then we would, Jacob, change the way that we fund our schools, we would adequately fund them, right, at a less complicated model that equalizes things, right? Yeah. And that would be a public health and public education system that people might, dare we say is a little socialist, right? So Jacob, I think, you know, the million-dollar question really, when you're talking dollars here, millions of dollars question, is why are we still funding schools this way when we know it's not appropriately funding what's necessary for all kids?
Really hate about that, Johnny, yeah, is that the fear of having a socialist system that might work better is, yeah, driving people not to recognize that we already have our states collecting money and distributing, yes, it to try to fix the system. We already have, yes, our federal government collecting money and distributing, yeah, it to try to fix the system. But the only thing they're preventing us from fixing this, and I want to ask you guys, what is a practical thing that can be changed to try to fix this system in the short term, you know, 3, 5, 10 years, not pie in the sky? But they're preventing us from being more efficient and saving money by having this horrible system that just doesn't seem to work very well. Tim, what's up with that? What up with that, Tim?
First of all, yeah, definitely. Just a quick add on to Johnny's. It's not even not caring about children. It's actually caring about maintaining exactly what is already in place, which is, you know, the inequitable distribution of the classes of people, and realizing who benefits from that continued underfunding in inequitable situations. But Jacob, you know, how do you fix it? What would be better? I think what Johnny kind of hinted at this, but you know, one of the first things that would, quote, make schools better would have nothing potentially to do with schools right away. But if we looked at something very simple, such as what we call Maslow's hierarchy of basic needs, such as food, healthcare, shelter, if we had any type of minimal standard that said, we are not going to send kids to school with empty stomachs, with poor clothing and housing, and healthcare is a given for any child in their family, that we take care of that. The then ready to come to school to actually take advantage of what is offered would change dramatically on that. And so to me, I'm kind of going out there going like, you know what? One of the things, this doesn't fix the broken funding for public education, but this really gets at the reality of what I think Johnny was saying. Do we value children? Well, let's value them first from the reality of going, do we provide simply the basic needs to be able to continue a life in this country that is truly, if you are committed to the pursuit of happiness, you gotta be not sick and you gotta be not hungry and you gotta be not wet and cold.
Well, yeah, and Jacob, I'll further simplify. So there's kind of two sides of the coin to responding to how do we fix this, right? And I'm gonna simplify, because I know listeners, there may be more than two sides of this coin, but I'm gonna simplified into two big camps. One is like what Tim and I are saying, and I think Jacob, you're saying, is why aren't we just making this like a universal public education system? Everybody's funded. It doesn't matter if you're in a poorer neighborhood or community or a wealthier community. This is the amount of money that you get, and it's adequate to providing what Tim's saying is like a holistic investment in young people, right? And that would be like, you know, funding a public education system, or what, you know, we've talked about on here with Jonathan Gierko about publicizing, right? But then the other side of the coin, Jacob, is your free market mindset that's saying, Jacob, we're in the process and it's a messy process, but competition is what's going to get us there. And, you know, taking the public away from it and privatizing this, not the old school private school, like, hey, you might go to Saint such and such, you know, usually religious identity around a private school and you pay a tuition kind of thing, but more or less kind of like applying the free market business model. The idea that like, hey, we should have a choice of where we go to eat, say like whether I go to McDonald's or Burger King or the local, you know, diner or, you know, Applebee's, I have a choice. And if they're going to serve a bad product, I'm probably not going to go there to eat. So that mindset, that idea that like competition levels the playing field and is the great equalizer, it might work in, say, you know, selling televisions or in choosing where you go to eat dinner, you know, the wants, not the needs. But in education, when you apply that economic philosophy to education, you start to say, and you create this, like you're saying, Jacob, this kind of a little of both, where we're still doing like a public education system, not quite as well as we should fund it, but we're also sprinkling in these competitions. So our public schools are competing. Again, remember, they're getting this money through enrollment numbers and through, you know, being sort of forced to compete in a free market. Public schools historically, and I would argue even today, aren't strong when they're competing as businesses. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's the side of the coin I'm on, Jacob. The other side of the coin are the free market, you know, folks who say, that's absolutely wrong, Johnny. Competition gets us there. You know, you have to provide a competitive option, you know, and then we start talking about, well, how are my kids going to get to that competitive option? We're just not designed. We don't have the infrastructure to be equalizing and free market in education. So if I'm to mediate that, I'm to say, okay, I'm not against free market in general. Like McDonald's and Burger King can hash it out with the public where you go to get the best fries and burgers. And, you know, and if they do a bad job or enough people get sick going there, they won't go there. That's not how it works in public schools. Mm-mm. And we're seeing that. So when enrollment declines and then funding declines, it's sort of like an avalanche. And we're not talking about wants like burgers and fries. We're talking about
emphasizing
absolute essentials, right? Like young people building a foundation for how they're going to participate in our state, in our community, in our economy, those things. So it's like why I'm saying public health and public education, it shouldn't be marketized. And that brings us to like our regular guest, Jonathan Gerico, talks about publicizing, right? He makes it a verb. We need to publicize our public school system, you know, remove that impetus of like providing a product and competing for businesses into a model of we're for the public good. We're mm-hmm. an absolute essential. We're an absolute need. That's the side of the coin I'm on. And there's good arguments from the other side of the coin, right? There, yeah. I kind of laid out that philosophy. So you may have listeners out there who are saying like, hey, you know, it's these charter options that are going to get us to a better education. Well, Tim and I would disagree.
Yeah.
But there are charters that are truly more public than even our public schools. And that's the interesting kind of moment we're in is that's when we start to say, Jacob, like you pointed out, the obvious, hey, if we look at this from the 10,000 foot view, why aren't we just operating public schools as sort of, a government funded, you know, great equalizer that it was designed to be an investment in the strength of our country?
If I may be so bold, as the host to offer my own view. I'm not sure if this is allowed in media, but I'm going to give it a shot.
Go for it.
I think free market stuff has a lot of value to it. I think that capitalism makes a lot of wealth, and it's because of that that we can try to distribute some of that wealth. If we didn't have this wonderful free market, we wouldn't have the money to try to give to people who need money. That's my personal view. But when it comes to this situation, think about McDonald's and Burger King competing, and that has some benefit to it when it, you know, bring prices down or have the best products. But when you bring that allegory into education, mm-hmm. the CEO of McDonald's isn't a shareholder who gets to help make decisions for Burger King. But if I'm running a charter school or if I'm promoting this vision of a paid education system, I'm also voting to continue making public schools worse to help my thing that I'm working on here, which exactly. does not seem like a fair competitive marketplace to me. So I think it's kind of hard to shoehorn that in as your version of what you want education to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the camp of deregulation helps become an equalizer, you know, great. Just stay away from education.
Yeah, there you go.
yeah, you know, like we'll give you that space to live out that experiment. You know, and Tim and I may poke a little bit more critically against capitalism as an economic model, but in the end, I'm with you. Like, hey, let it do its thing. instead of, like you pointed out, Jacob, the conflicting interests,
mm-hmm, right,
that oppose. And that's where we're really hard on legislation and legislators. Like, hey, you know, support and protect our public schools. Remember, this is the bedrock of our democracy. This is the investment we have on our the strength of our states, the strength of our communities, the strength of our nation, ultimately. So, you know, regulation in that world isn't necessarily a bad thing. Where in free market capitalism, right, in the McDonald's Burger King war, you know, or maybe it's the back, Tim, when we were young, it was Pepsi and Coke,
yeah,
you know, and you know, what was it? Budweiser versus, what was the other one? Was it Miller, right?
It was Miller Lite and Budweiser. Yeah,
the beer wars. So those, like Jacob said, those CEOs are advocating in the interests of the profit for their companies. That should be, if that's going to be a thing, cool. Let it be its thing, right? But don't necessarily apply it to all areas. And I know, like people in the healthcare world are also having this out.
Yeah.
Right, because we're seeing it with public and private hospitals, right, in healthcare system in this country with insurance and all these things. It is not equal, right?
It's not equal. And they say, you know, here we are, man. The producer's choice segments are getting nice.
Hey, it's a heavy show today.
Yeah, it's heavy stuff. No, it's good because we get into some great conversations. But you know, I think the competition and all that, and we've got to come back to this concept of, quote, what we say, our needs, right? And even the competition model in an economic theory of, you know, capitalism in this country, there's also a reason why there are regulations on competition even there. Now, we're trying to break them down, but it comes from this concept of saying that everybody who comes to the free market should have some type of an equitable footing to be able to compete, right? You can't compete. And here, though, too, and I say we got to separate this out, education, the need, it's a need here. So even if you believe in competition, how do we create a level field to compete on? And I don't even want to go there. Well, we're not doing that. We're not even creating a playing field, an equipment, you know, a roster, materials. None of that is allowing certain groups of people to come to, God forbid, a competition and be able to compete equally in this. And so when we're talking about schooling, if you want to compete after you graduate to be in the marketplace of capitalism and ideas, let's at least say that education is a need. And so we're going to fund that need so that, yeah, later on, I guess, go out and compete. But, you know, that would really require us to, as Johnny said, we got to get away from the competition market capitalism model as a philosophy to drive education. Because it to me, it's very damaging, corrupting, and it just creates inequalities and it breeds it. And so when it comes, yeah, funding, boy, Jacob, deep question, powerful,
Tim,
loving it.
If I could say education is a need, I think that's a great place to leave us off on our main discussion. I asked you guys, I believe, two questions, and it has been an hour and a half. But you guys have a lot to say, and that's good. I think that proves the quality of the questions. I have one last question for you guys, though. It's something we like to do here on the Producer's Choice Show. I believe you guys have been on the program before, so this is nothing you haven't heard. But I'm going to ask you a very special question, actually.
Let's go!
This is our 60-second question. Dr. Tim Slecker, in 60 seconds, it doesn't have to be the most important thing. But what is one thing close to your heart that you would like to see more funding for in education?
I would like to see funding for healthy, nutritious meals provided for every child for both breakfast and lunch. Right there. Boom.
Boom.
Mic drop.
That's a great answer, Tim. Johnny, again, it doesn't have to be the most important thing. Everything's important, but what's something that you really care about that you'd like to see funding for in education?
I was going to say the same thing as Tim, but since he's already getting that wish granted by Jacob, you, the genie here today. Well, good with that. It would be, you know, food for everybody, right? And the next most important thing is, I would say, access to pediatric health care.
Yeah.
Right. So they like all the kids have access to, you know, a local pediatrician through their schools so that their, you know, basic health and their wellness is accounted for in those early formative years.
Fantastic answers, guys. Thank you so much for being here. I got a scram, but I believe, Tim, it's time for something special.
Yeah, you know, it is time for the moment of Zen. We all know individuals, most of them unsung, unrecognized, who have, often in the most modest ways, spoken out or acted on their beliefs for a more egalitarian, more just, peace-loving society.
Thanks for listening to today's Producer's Choice. And if you want to grab more Busted Pencils podcasts, just head on over to Apple, Spotify, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. And you can always find us on civicmedia.com or on our website, bustedpencils.com. And remember, you can find great Busted Pencils content every Monday for homeroom, Wednesdays for class and session, and on Fridays for Producer's Jacob's Choice. And of course, Pencil Busters, you can always tune in on Saturday and listen to the Busted Pencils weekend broadcast at 3 p.m. Central Time across all the Civic Media networks for that 1 hour of your favorite blue-collar scholars, Tim and Johnny, and keep busting pencils.